Question. Why do we talk out loud when we know we're alone? Conjecture. Because we know we're not. Evolution perfects survival skills. There are perfect hunters. There is perfect defense. Question. Why is there no such thing as perfect hiding?
Answer. How would you know? Logically, if evolution were to perfect a creature whose primary skill were to hide from view, how could you know it existed? It could be with us every second and we would never know. How would you detect it? Even sense it? Except in those moments when for no clear reason you choose to speak aloud. What would such a creature want? What would it do? Well, what would you do?
Something outside.
What is that?
Another episode of Monster X Radio. Shane here, and Monster X Radio is, of course, brought to you by Sasquatch Coffee. Have you tried it, Yeti? We're getting into the holidays here, and if you guys enjoy coffee, or you know someone who does, hey, why don't you guys look at and ordering some Monster X, or sorry, excuse me, some Sasquatch Coffee. Maybe we'll get a Monster X variety down the road here, but right now, Sasquatch Coffee is where it's at. It's delicious. I enjoy it. So get yourself a bag or two, and it makes a perfect gift. Having said that, that intro, the first audio you heard on the show, that's from the show Doctor Who, Season 8, Episode 4, aired back in September of 2014, and it was entitled Listen. And I played that because it's going to play a little part in our show today, our discussion with my good friend and fellow researcher Larry Turner, who's going to join us today. That when I first heard that clip, and I love the show Doctor Who. It's just an interesting show. When I first heard that clip, I thought, wow, that kind of what if something had adapted to hide itself so well? How would you know? I mean, it could be, you know, especially when you're in the woods all around you, and you just never know. We already have known animals that do that all the time. What if something had adapted itself so well that that was its primary function to hide? And that clip from the Doctor Who show spoke to me. And I asked Larry Turner to join me today on the show to discuss things of this nature and one's approach, whether you're researching or not, in the woods. and he had some valuable insight, I think, have been, you know, something that he takes to heart as far as how Sasquatch may perceive you and your demeanor when you're entering the woods, especially if it's built and adapted like I think it is to be the ultimate hide-and-seek champion. And so, Larry Turner, are you there with me, my friend?
I sure am, Shane.
Well, glad to have you, Larry. What did you think of that that clip from the Doctor Who show?
Boy, that was just absolutely awesome. I liked it. It spoke to me as well. Really to what I believe, if we go into an unknown creature such as Sasquatch, and how they, like in the dark, they have it's my perception is they know just the right amount of distance to stay invisible within the darkness moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking about this and looking in nature, you know as well as I do that you and I could walk right by a black-tailed deer and never even see it because they just freeze. Now, take for a moment a Sasquatch, and what is the average color of a Sasquatch that you've heard?
I would say brown, somewhere along the brown or an auburn color or even black. I mean, those are the three colors that stick out in my head, with the rare one being the albino or white or gray looking one.
Right. Now let's push that a little bit further. So as you walk in the woods, what are the darker shades of colors that you see?
Well, yeah, they're dark. I mean, if you're in the deeper parts of the woods, there's a lot of shadows that play a part. You know, you got a lot of, especially
exactly.
Pacific Northwest, you got a lot of moss and deep, dark woods. And so
exactly.
if you look at your known animals, your deer, your elk, your bear, you know, they tend to blend in quite naturally and quite nicely.
Right. And moving forward, thinking about something that is in these color shades and within 50 yards of a shaded forest, you've got sunlight, you've got stumps, you've got darks, you know, dark colors, the whole array of dark colors while you're walking around up in the woods. It's been said a lot of them peek around trees, maybe. I've never really seen one do that myself, but these particular colors, they're perfectly adapted to just be still or just hunker down. If you move that a little bit forward, since these creatures are, wood, you know, they live out in the woods, push that a little bit forward and say, you and I lived out in the woods for like 3 years. I don't think that we would have any problem evading man. We would know that they would be coming. We'd hear their trucks. We'd hear their footsteps. We'd smell them. We would know exactly what to do to evade their sight as well. We just don't have the amazing agility that these things have.
Right. No, those are fantastic points. One of the things you were just talking about, the environment being, you know, in some of these areas, you know, dark, damp, cold, and a spot where something can conceal itself. Now you put into effect something that, you know, a lot of these sightings, you know, people say, you know, it was motionless. I saw it and then it moved slightly, or and that's how they noticed it. How long was that Sasquatch in the picture being motionless because it had basically camouflaged itself into its background? You know, by staying motionless, it looks like a stump, it looks like a tree, it looks like a bush. You know, bear and deer, I mean, they do the same thing. What I liked about the Doctor Who clip was the fact that it begins out with listen. And that's something that is a key thing that I think Sasquatch utilizes, is the advancement of its probably extreme hearing, possibly. But with humans, one of the things when we go into the woods, we really don't listen enough, I think. You know, hunters, they do, because it's something they've developed over time to be a keen and good hunter. How how important is it to really listen when you're looking, you know, for something that is adapted to hiding? Really being an expert hider. How do you get yourself to listen attentively, and you know, being in the woods?
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. And I'm going to use myself as an example. And you and I have talked about this quite extensively. Mankind, us, we typically live in cities or rural areas. There's a lot of population around. The energy is different. It's very high. It's kind of, in my opinion, kind of could short circuit what we as man have been designed for. We've lost our latent skills, our latent hunting skills, survival skills, and don't have that connection with the forest anymore. When I go out in the forest, per se, the first thing I do after I set up camp is I go away. I go as far as away, you know, far enough away that I don't hear anything, and I sit and decompress. And what I mean by decompressing is letting the city life go away, if you will. And I start concentrating on listening to the sounds of the forest. They're subtle. It starts out kind of subtle. I usually try to take 15, 20 minutes. And kind of doing what, for lack of a better term, tuning your senses. And what I mean is like, say, for instance, in the summer. First thing I do is I kind of shut myself down and I start listening. The first sound, the most prominent sound in the forest here in the Pacific Northwest are the bees. It's just buzzing like you wouldn't believe. You typically, you know, if a person came out in the forest like they just drove up and started hiking around, they'd never hear the bees. Next thing that fills in is the birds. There's different varieties of birds and stuff. You start picking that up. And there's these different layers that happen as you're tuning into the environment, if you will. And all of a sudden, everything's on loud. The next thing that happens, then your ears are set. My eyes are closed. I'm still listening to stuff. I then start tuning my sense of smell. And you know, just to one breath at a time, pretty soon that gets tuned to where you could smell the forest floor, the different stages of composition of the forest matter that's on the floor becomes what would be normal that you would be smelling. And so forth. And then with your eyes, you open your eyes, you adapt to the light that's in the forest. It's kind of a shaded light, sort of like what you'd be, a little bit darker than sunglasses. And after a time, your vision gets to a point where you can see a flick. Oh, that's a bird. Oh, that's a deer just flicked his ears. And then with the smell or the sound, the first thing is, as a hunter myself, as I go by sound, and when I listen for my game, which is deer or elk or bear, the thing is, they're just as noisy as we are out in the woods if you pay attention, if you're listening. And some, the bear are a little bit quieter because they got nice big pads. Equate that to a Sasquatch. You know, I've never snuck up on one. I'm usually sitting there. I'm not looking for them. I'm kind of just stealthily moving along. And when I hunt, is I'll move like maybe 100 yards, and then I'll stop for like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I just sit, look, listen, smell. And that's kind of the way, by doing so, you tune yourself into this, into the environment. That's, we all have this ability to do it, but I think most of people have lost their connective way to the, you know, to the woods or to the forest or to nature, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Larry. It makes a lot of sense to me. You know, I think it's something, that ability to really, and I'm not getting woo on people, but become one with the nature, become one with the surroundings. You know, hunters, you know, like I said, use this. Naturalists do this. And those that really want to escape and enjoy nature, and enjoy the sounds, you know. But you, Larry, it's something I do believe that most have lost, this ability to really sit down and obtain all the sounds in the forest and differentiate the different sounds and stuff. I think people really lost this, and it's something to be enjoyed regardless of the Sasquatch phenomena. But Larry, do you think this applies to research? Do you think that people are lacking this today? And if so, if you do believe it applies to research, how does it this you know, ability to really, you know, kind of soothe yourself into your surroundings, do you think it applies to research, and how so?
Well, absolutely it does. To give you an idea, and then I'll go segue into your questions. Basically, just like I was talking to you about me decompressing, and then the longer you stay out in the woods, the more natural it feels. I think there's a latent fear in folks these days that they won't admit to, but the woods are kind of a scary place. Puts off, and you can, I can only equate this to other animals, is that you've heard that big cats can smell fear, or other animals can sense fear. I think if you're not comfortable in, within the environment, in a way that you're pretty much, you just go to sleep right out there, which I kind of do once in a while, take a nap, you know. But that's kind of like my second home, being out in the woods. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't mind living out there year round, but that can't happen because I got to make money.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of that money thing. But
yeah.
I've gotten to a point where I've been trying to teach my son, and very few people can do this. Maybe Derek can too, but when you're so in tune with your environment, and I'm talking about the deepest part of the woods, I used to hunt what's called deep woods elk, and they're, you know, they stick down to the bottoms of the canyons in the dark stuff, that after a while, you can actually feel a pressure wave as they walk out as they're moving across the forest within 20 yards, but you can't see them. The pressure wave is sort of like a temperature gradient. It's kind of like a radar, for lack of a better term. I can't really explain it. But there's when an animal walks by within close proximity and you can't see it, there's a pressure wave just because, you know, of them moving through the air, that type of sense. We have that ability to actually feel this stuff, but it's so buried, you know, and it takes a long time for a person to be able to turn on these senses that we all carry within us. Moving forward, of course, it's important, you know, for us to bring this type of mythology into your research. It does two things. First of all, it relaxes you. I believe that just like when I'm walking around, like I was walking around this weekend, walked right up to a deer, you're almost pretty close to a deer, walked right up to a herd of elk. There's hunters running around all over the place out in the woods, and these guys here were just as calm as ice. Why? I wasn't really hunting for them, for one thing, and I moved methodically slow and quiet. I try not to make as much noise as like what everybody else does. Now, it's got a double-edged sword sometimes with that, because they expect man to be making a bunch of noise, but it also, you know, if you're in a calm demeanor and you're not really, you know, what's the word I'm doing, you know, in an aggressive stance, I think that brings more animals in, or curious, going, that guy's acting different. They're just as perceptive as we are, probably more so. You know, they can read body. I believe that animals can read body language or intent, just like I can read their body language and demeanor. And I think if we go, like, for instance, I'm not really looking for Bigfoot. When Bigfoot shows up, for whatever reason, it just happens that way. I'm doing something else. I think if your intent's just to kind of, I think, for lack of a better word, just relax, be in a relaxed state, and not as hyper-vigilant, like, what was that sound? Just take with
right.
a grain of salt and move towards that sound, but in a slow, methodical way.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'm picking up what you're putting down, absolutely. And I think, you know, Larry, you've been a hunter for a good majority of your life. I know some fantastic hunters, and there's usually, if you're a really good hunter, there's a lot of things – people are doing alike. You know, you're not, you know, if you're out hunting, say, elk, you're not going to be smashing through the brush, stomping around, you know, crashing around. And you're going in with, you know, and I'm not speaking for all hunters. I'm sure there's a lot of successful hunters out there. But your demeanor and your actions, I think, speak volumes in the woods without maybe speaking, you know, without making a whole lot of noise. It's just your actions in general, quick movements and stuff. I think that's a key thing. And to a lot of hunters being successful. You know, I often wonder, pardon me, I often wonder, you know, why Bob Gimlin and Roger Patterson on their horses out in Bluff Creek had the opportunity to record on video, you know, a Sasquatch. You know, I often wonder how that came about and how they were lucky to do that. And something I need to ask Bob, you know, what was their demeanor? Because I've never asked him. You know, I've talked to Bob, I don't know how many times, and he's a friend of mine, but I've never actually asked him, hey, Bob, what was your demeanor when you guys were out there? Yet you were on horses, yes, and some people say because you guys were on horses, you got that footage because it sounded, you know, it didn't sound human-like. It was something, you know, could have sounded like an elk or anything else. But what was you guys' demeanor that day, both you guys? What was your, you know, looking back, your perception, your intent? You know, I know their intent, but I don't know their intent, you know, how they were exuding that intent. And I often wonder, you know, if they were, you know, being woodsmen and outdoorsmen and hunters and very good at all of the above, if that played a role into why, you know, or they just plain got lucky. I don't know, being in the right place at the right time, which, you know, I think plays a part in a lot of Sasquatch sightings. But it's the demeanor and the actions displayed, you know, to creep up on something. You know, like you were just talking about, Larry, you know, having come across that deer, you know, and then the elk you came across this, you know, this past weekend. We've done that before, and I know you've done that, but it really is about, and we're not talking about hunting, just being out in the woods, exploring, and enjoying our environment plays a huge role. But I got to ask Bob Gimlin someday, hopefully sooner than later, you know, about this subject, because I'm curious if it played a role into why they actually got something on video. You know, I mean, what do you think?
I've actually got part of that. I think I got part of that answer. If there is an indigenous population of elk in that area, I don't know. But horse and elk smell an awful lot alike. So you have the scent factor going for you right there. Mm-hmm. The horses are masking the human scent. Now, one of the things that's really interesting for me, at least when I'm out around, and again, Patty has lived out in the woods all of her life and knows all the smells, right? Well, the same thing, you know, when I decompress and I use hearing first, you know, and a matter of fact, it depends on what the windage and stuff, is I'll use smell and the sense of smell. It's very heightened after so much time in the woods, or, you know, as you decompress, that, you know, I don't think I could differentiate that much between a horse and an elk. There are differences, but, you know, at the first blast, I don't think you could tell the difference. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is a you know, unless you're good at pheromones, I'm not, you know, that type of thing, but pheromones or whatever it is that, you know, makes the animal unique that they are. But since these guys are sitting on top of sweaty horses and stuff, they smell like horse. Also, you know, there's animal ungulate sounds coming from the horses as they're coming down the trail. I think that wouldn't alarm an apex predator, probably cause more curiosity, in my opinion, where they'd be going, what is coming down there? They, you know, who knows? Maybe she was watching them and decided, oh, couple guys on horses and just walks off. The fascinating thing about that footage is she's walking, not running, walking away. I've always found that fascinating. So she wasn't even alarmed. You know, I'm thinking about this is that mankind and Sasquatch have been bumping into each other for millennia, you know, through Indian legend and stuff like that. I think they well know that we're the most dangerous thing in the woods just because we use weapons. So they know our reach, per se. And I don't think they want to have nothing to do with us. I mean, we're pretty violent, you know, and that's kind of the way I kind of perceive that, you know, I watch that film from Patty Inside Out and backwards. She's not alarmed. She's just walking away. I always found that interesting. I mean, I asked Bob, how close were you to her? He goes, less than 30 yards. He was pulling out his 30-30 out of the scabbard to cover up Patterson in case she became aggressive and headed over his way. Nope, she just kept on going. You know?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of discussion there. You know, I don't want to switch gears in the show, but I'll just mention that. You know, there's a lot of discussion there. You know, Patty seemed to be looked like she was, you know, either had given birth or had given birth or was about to. Pardon me. But maybe she was luring them away from some youngins. I mean, it's all you know, conjecture.
Yeah,
absolutely. A lot of thoughts behind that. I'm not trying to switch gears on the show here, but you did mention Native Americans, and I think that's an important aspect when we're talking about this show about, you know, being kind of in one with, you know, your surroundings and listening, is that, you know, Native American lore have, you know, they basically, you know, report have being around these things quite frequently, and you have to wonder why. Well, one I have to say is that they were living in that environment all the time. Their survival depended on being able to hunt and thrive, and so if they were not listening, you know, I mean, they didn't have the distractions like nowadays where you have the you know, cars and cell phones and computers and bells and whistles and all this stuff. They pretty much, the noises they heard and were, you know, of themselves and nature in general. And so there's a key element there. Yeah, that I think something we lack because we're not living in that environment, so we don't get to experience all of that. And yet, and even differentiate the different sounds out there. I mean, if you know, I wish I had been alive back then because I guarantee I would have learned a lot, you know, the different sounds that I assume I know, and sometimes I don't.
You hit that on the head. It's an amazing thing when you think back how, you know, how the tribal Americans and Native peoples, how they lived one with the land. And think about that, one with the land. They only took what they needed and lived pretty much a peaceful existence. There wasn't many skirmishes. There were some Indian war skirmishes, but there wasn't, not like present day. So they were pretty much peaceful, at least the ones here in the Pacific Northwest and stuff like that. I've always thought how they, moved with the seasons. They harvested deer, they fish, the berries. I mean, the huckleberries, oh my gosh. They're just coming on up there in the up there at where you live. Just crazy nuts. I mean, all over the place. I mean, what a harvest. Food sources everywhere. And I think they're still getting, those things were still getting ripe up there. Just amazing what nature provides. You know, and I just think that with regards to the Native peoples and like the hunters that might be listening right now, maybe they can relate to what I was saying, especially with regards to decompression. It's just I think most people have lost we've just lost our ability to adapt to what's really natural, which is, you know, the environment. We live in an artificial environment with all sorts of noise, whether you hear it or not. I mean, our lights are putting out 60 hertz of a frequency. You know, we're basically short-circuiting ourselves. All sorts of stuff going on. TVs putting out 120 hertz. Like you said, the computers, everything. We live in a very noisy environment. If you don't think that affects the human body, you're wrong. It does. I think we are short-circuited. We all have a resonance frequency. You know, this is actually the way we're supposed to be. Living in the artificial environment we are with today's electronics, all the noise from freeways and cars, The perfumes and all sorts of stuff that's not even natural, you know, for what we would normally do or normally did back then, we're pretty short-circuited, and that's why it takes a little bit longer for somebody like me. Well, for me, it doesn't take that long to switch off city and switch on woods because I go out quite often.
Right.
But for a layman or for somebody who goes, I'm going to go out Sasquatching, well, you get this to learn how to do. You just can't wake up in the morning and become I'm going to go out and research. It just doesn't, good luck. It's not going to work. And, most of the people that see have sightings, they're not looking for Bigfoot. They're out for a Sunday drive. That's the other thing, too, is acting natural, doing what humans do, sitting at a campfire, minding your own business, go to sleep. They show up, snort one more snoring, whatever. But that's kind of the word. I think that if you're acting natural and non-aggressive, I think that lends credence to where it piques their curiosity. This guy's not normal. There's something different about that guy. I'm going to pay attention to him.
Right.
That's kind of where
it's
I'm
funny.
Going with that.
Yeah, because, I would imagine, perhaps, and just throwing this out there as a hypothesis or idea, but with your Native Americans, First Nations people, they were fairly, I won't say totally predictable, but somewhat predictable. And nowadays you have people out in the woods that are so unpredictable because nowadays everybody's doing crazy stuff. No animal is safe as to knowing what a human's going to do nowadays because people are just doing all sorts of crazy things, and not being natural. Whereas Native Americans were much more natural in their environment, nowadays we're so visually stimulated. Everything has to be visual. We've kind of lost that
right.
Listening and feeling being out in nature. Now we need to be visually stimulated. We have to get something on film, It's a visual stimulation rather than a hearing stimulation, it's nuts. And I think that really I don't think enough researchers nowadays, everybody's so keen on throwing something on YouTube visually or Facebook or getting in, on the news, that it's all about visual. And we lack so much in the endeavor of research by doing this and true research. I look at people like Jane Goodall. Her approach when she – and I'm not saying Sasquatch is an ape. I lean that direction, some sort of primate. But with nature and being involved in nature, Jane Goodall is a perfect example as to her approach. Imagine if she was, out there with the chimps, these chimpanzees and whatnot, and she was stomping around the woods making a fool of herself and not really taking in what she, in understanding the chimpanzees, she would have never got to where she is nowadays. In fact, it never would have happened, and she probably would have put herself in harm's way being that close to them. It's something that we lack. I think, we've lost this touch with nature, do you agree, Larry?
Well, you danced all around something that I think we should talk about, and that is most people have lost their respect for nature. In that same sense, talking about Jane Goodall, if you looked at any of the films that she had great respect for the power that was before her, i.e. the chimps. Chimps are 8 times stronger than a human being. That's pretty powerful in itself. Nature is powerful. People just kind of arbitrarily start running around out in the woods thinking they're going to do this or that. Well, the woods is a dangerous place. There's a power there that people forget about. You can get hurt. You can get killed. There are animals out there that can kill you. A deer can kill you just by his front hoofs, just by doing a kick. And then mountain lions, they can break an elk's neck with one swipe of its paw. I mean, there's power out there. I think that people don't realize that they need to respect. Even when walking around the woods, and rather running here and there and whooping and stuff like that, that's not natural. You know what I mean? There's different ways to research, and that's just kind of like being quiet, maybe being quiet, being respectful in a way when you're walking through the woods, a little bit more quieter in your footsteps, and keeping your eyes peeled. Look for that flicker of movement. Look for that, you know, that's what I do is I use my periphery vision a lot, and that's something you have to train yourself with. That's most of the time when I see my animals, they're not right in front of me. They're in my periphery.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
And those are things you have to really think about.
Well, you know, with a lot of researchers, and myself included, you know, I seem to get a lot of really solid, interesting recordings when I'm asleep or really quiet, and I think that plays a role. You know, those researchers or people out in the woods, you know, that claim to have stuff happen, you know, there's a lot of questions there, but one of the things I've noticed over the years is the power of being quiet and listening. And I do think it's a double-edged sword, because I think if you're acting unnatural in the environment, you know, if you're out there in the woods and you're not making noise, that Sasquatch and animals in general might be kind of like, huh, there was noise and now there's no noise. And so there's a double-edged sword there, but I think there's a difference, because a lot of researchers go in the field with this intention, and there's some vibe coming off them that may possibly scare off anything, you know, that may be around the area, regardless of it's Sasquatch or not, because of this I don't even know the word. I wanted to say vibe. You know, I think a lot of things can pick up on
that's
that.
A good way.
Known animals. Yeah.
I think that's a good way to describe it. The vibe, I mean, think about it. I mean, animals by their very nature have to observe everything to survive, right? So if the guy's walking around, you know, and he's pounding on trees and kind of whooping and stuff like that, or he's walking very fast in a single direction and then suddenly stops and looks and listens, hunters don't even do that. But we take our time. We sit down, we listen, you know, that type of thing. Some of us walk around like ninja warriors, if you will, real quiet in our footsteps and stuff. There's different ways of going about it. But the thing is I think in a way, some people, when they're, and I've been around a few people I've been trying to teach, there's a hurriness. Everyone's in a hurry, you know, and I think that's because they haven't let go where they just came from, the city, to slow it down. So when those themselves to this environment, which is our natural environment, you know, that's what I keep on trying to tell people. This is our natural environment. The house isn't. That's where we sleep. But I sleep just as well out in the woods. Matter of fact, I sleep harder out in the woods than I do in my own house.
You
know
both.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't take much. And the thing is that I think we just need to dial it back some and and think about the intent that you have while you're out there. And like I said, all animals observe. They know what's going on with you. Well, they'll even know that you're coming before you even know they're there.
Right.
Another good
right.
good point. You know, they're already watching you. You know,
mm-hmm.
their eyes are keyed
yeah.
on movement.
Absolutely.
You know,
no,
that
that's another. I mean, yeah, that's another great point is observation. You know, I mean, listening is one thing, but if you're, you know, nowadays we're so keen on this virtual stimulation, I don't think we're really keen on what observing and observation really is. You know, we're twitchy. We're looking back and forth. Oh, what's that? What's this? You know, and fasten our movements. It's you know, as a hunter, you know, it does. If you're twitchy in the field and moving back and forth, that you stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, there's no hiding that. You know, if you look at a lot of animal movements, they're very slow, methodical. They know, because if they make the wrong movement, their cover is gone. And I think Sasquatch does the same thing, you know. How many reports have I heard of a Sasquatch laying motionless or still for 20 minutes or longer? Some people saying they never knew they were there. You know, I was talking to Barcatino, who has some of the best thermal footage out there, you know, talking about his first view through a thermal of a Sasquatch and its movement, how methodical it was, how slow. It was, you know, it's really amazing that, you know, that was a human. I mean, I just couldn't see a human staying still that long. And that's one of the things that we lack is that methodical movement. You know, hunters, and there's other individuals out there very capable of doing this and that do it, but as a vast majority, when it comes to those in the woods, whether it's a researcher or a naturalist or a hiker or whatever, we're fast in our movements, and we stick out like a sore thumb scaring everything away. And it's no wonder that we don't get more out of the Sasquatch phenomenon than we do, you know, now, because everybody's trying to get that killer piece of footage and whatnot. We're not seeing the forest through the trees, so to speak.
Exactly. The whole thing is I think we just need to slow it down. Slow it down in the sense of just relaxing. I, for lack of a better term, I've been around a lot of people that have been in the woods that they're super tense, whether they're afraid of the environment internally or they just want to hurry up. Like when I'm hunting with somebody, especially I haven't hunted before, I just like this guy wants to kill something. I'm at a point in my life, I can care less if I kill anything anymore. My whole thing, how close can I get to it? I'm more into stalking these days. And it's more of a challenge to me. That's why I archery hunt. And I've even passed up big bulls just to see how close I can get to them. You know, it's like walk right up to one, and I tap one right between his antlers one time with my arrow. My son and my other buddies were completely, I can't believe you didn't shoot that. I was more in trying to see if I could walk up to him without even him knowing it. And I did it. The one thing I've learned in the years of being in the forest is I let the animals teach me. And that's through observation of how they move, they do, what they eat, and this is deer, elk, and bear, just how they act in their environment. Great teaching tools that I try to emulate when I'm out in the woods. But that only comes through observation to understand how they move, how they feed, what they do when they're looking around. You know, all sorts of, it's really interesting is when you start to mimic the animals that you hunt and their movements. And I just find it, and it's relaxing too. If you're relaxed, they're relaxed. And they do, I just know this because I've seen it over and over again. If there's those sudden movements and somebody's going to pull up, these sudden movements and stuff spook them. But if it's calm and methodical, you're part of the environment, and they don't care.
Well, reading the environment, Larry, I know you're a big fisherman, and I know I've seen the pictures with you, salmon fishing and steelhead fishing. And I know, I'm a big fisherman too. And part of being a fisherman, I take a lot of how I fish into the field as far as research. You know, I'm always trying to find that pinch point or that area where the fish are going to be at. I try to read the seasons, the water, the area I'm fishing in, and what the fish are doing. I'm always trying to read that, and I've become fairly successful doing that. And I know you've done it because I've seen your pictures. I know you've been to Alaska. And, in fact, you've been around grizzly and got to see them firsthand. I've seen grizzly behind a cage, but I've never, unfortunately, got to see a grizzly in its natural environment. I know you have, so you got a lot of experience there.
Yeah, I've been close to grizzly, black bear, and the coastal brown bears. I've been, 30, 40 feet from them. Again, you have to read the animal. I mean, there's especially with bears, it's a whole different ball game on how to deal with these animals. They're highly aggressive. Their eyesight is horrible. Their body language is totally different, and you have to let them talk to you in a way that if they're pissed off, you'll know. Some are calm, some are, aggressive. It's quite an interesting thing to watch. But after a few weeks up in Alaska hanging around with this sow brown bear, Coastal Brown, and her cubs, she taught me a lot about herself and how at least some of the ones are around there. They're pretty much just interested in the fish. You're intruding into their on their you're standing on their dinner table. Gotta understand that. It's their dinner table and we're an intruder. And that's kind of how I take it, you know, from spending time up in Alaska, spending as much time as I'm out in the woods. You know, you're walking in these animals' dinner table, if you stop to think about it. The clear cuts, for instance, everyone thinks that, you know, a lot of people think that deer, elk, and bear eat out in the woods. No, that's their bedroom. They eat around the peripheries of a clear cut or in a clear cut. That's where the food sources are, or in open areas. But again, when you're walking through these areas, you're either walking through the bedroom, get on their dinner table. It's a whole different thing when you're walking on a dinner table. You've got to, you know, that's when you got to go really slow and quiet. You know, and that's when you see the animals. Or if you're walking in their bedroom, i.e. the woods. Another thing is that they're kind of bedded down, relaxing and stuff like that. And that's kind of how I look at things when I'm out walking around or taking my time walking around. Those are the two rooms, if you will. The bedroom, the woods, the open spots, the dinner table. It's kind of how I look at it.
That's interesting, you know, when you mentioned clear cuts too, because, you know, a lot of Sasquatch sightings seem to occur, even in our Tillamook area and some of these other areas where reports come from, around clear cuts. I mean, how many reports have we heard of Sasquatch being in and around, or multiple Sasquatch being in and around clear cuts? I don't think it's where they live, just like the bear and everything else, but it's where they come to feed, you know, and that's a really interesting insight because it's true. I mean, you got a lot of reports from being in and around clear cuts, you know, where you got this, you know, fresh growth and this fresh, you know, reprod and everything else, it's kind of like a garden, you know, it's a garden. It's not where these things reside. It's where they come to feed. Both prey and predator.
Exactly.
Yeah, both prey and predator. And you know this for a fact, Larry. Where do a lot of hunters end up?
Sitting on top of clear cuts. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But the funny thing is you know, like as an archery hunter myself, and it's like 1,000 degrees outside, 100-something degrees outside. I'm not really hanging out near the dinner table per se because that's what usually. They hit that like late at night until about 3 a.m. Then they go to water sources, and then they go to their bedroom. Usually deep down on the bottom of, you know, the deepest, darkest part of the woods to get away from the heat, the extreme heat, and also the insects. You got, you know, the heat and insects play a massive role in animal behavior that you got to understand in order to find them. And we could also equate that as well to an 8-foot-tall apex predator. They're going to be bothered by heat. They're heat sensitive, just like we are. They can't take off their clothes. They're going to be around a water source. And,
well, you just mentioned,
you know,
something
deeper in the woods.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I was just going to say, people don't do that. You know, people don't do that. People don't go to the deepest part. Dark spots of the woods, you know, we get bugs on us and we start spraying ourselves and we like, oh, there's a lot of bugs over there. I'm not going that direction. I mean, that's just people in general. But you're talking about something that has to hide for a living. Where are they going to go? You know, where are they going to go? We're not going to think about these dark spots. One, because it's not somewhere we want to be. And two, we don't know, you know, as humans, you know, that may be a reprieve from the insects, but you guarantee your Sasquatch, your and everything else, they know where to go, but we don't, and we don't go to those spots. We just don't. They're dangerous. They're dark. We're not built for that environment. Blah blah blah.
Exactly. Now here's another thing too, especially in the Pacific Northwest. In every deep dark canyon, there is a body of water that runs through them. Every single one. That's an interesting fact. It's a fact. I mean, you can just take a look. It's a drainage. And so the water runs through and runs into a bigger stream and so forth and down to a river. But the deepest, darkest spots, I mean, it's not often that people have daylight sightings. I happen to have one at 12:15 p.m. What was that, last March? But it was coming out of one of those deep, dark places. And this was in March, from a water source. But even that experience there taught me something. It taught me where it came from, and as a mental note to myself, as a place to search later, or to investigate later, to go down in one of these deep, dark places and do something and methodically wander around. I think that's an area that should be of interest. Also, about halfway up the ridge, halfway up one of these hills, there's like one of these crevasses, or not crevasses, you know, the deep, dark places. About halfway up is where, I've found many cougar, I found elk, you know, big bull elk. They sit about halfway up, and there's kind of like a ledgy thing that, you know, that they'll sit on to observe. And those are places that need to be looked at too. A great place to set audio. Think about that. It's just above. It's in between. You get the echoes. You get a sense of direction. Great places to check out. Again,
well, Larry,
slow and methodical.
Let me cut you off real quick because I want to lead into the audio aspect, because I know, Larry, you've been on the show before with audio and talking about audio, but these, you know, I often say that if you're going to find possible bones of a Sasquatch or any critter, especially, you know, it's probably going to be in these deep, dark crevasses, areas, these deep, dark places. You know, if I'm going to go out there and die, I would imagine if I'm something like a Sasquatch, it's going to be somewhere where I can die in peace, where no one's going to find me. And that's just, you know, a guesstimation. I don't know. I'm not a Sasquatch. I'm not a cougar. But a lot of the, you know, we don't find a whole lot of cougar bones or bear bones or any Sasquatch bones.
No, we don't.
I would imagine I'm going to go into the deepest, darkest crevice. I'm going to go somewhere where no one's going to find me. And then I'll die peacefully and nature can take its course. But, you know, that leads into the audio aspect, you know, or placement of audio and other things. You know, we were talking about this before the show, and we've talked about many times, just over a campfire or being out in the woods, about effective research and an effective placement of audio. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, let's see. If any of you of your listeners are interested, we'll talk about something here for a little bit, but grab yourself a pencil and a piece of paper, and I'm going to give you the audio settings that I use that would be best for everybody to use, because it'll shorten up your recording time and give you the best quality so that others can evaluate it. We've done this before for placement of audio. We get pretty tricky out there. I mean,
right.
We find some pretty nice, let's say we find a nice sincere spot. We find this real nice oak tree or a maple tree or whatever. And say the crotch or the split is like 12 feet up. I'd help Shane get up there and he would set up a recorder in there and we'd bury it in moss. That's 12 feet up. It's pointed off. It doesn't matter what direction, especially right now, because we don't know what's going on in that area. That's a good way to survey an area. What I mean by that is if you got a bunch of recorders and you're in an area and you say you're a mile from camp, why not set a recorder there? Let it soak in that environment. Let it run for 12 hours. And after that 12 hours, you're going to find out what's in the area. Might get some cool stuff. What did I leave home with? What, 6 recorders? You bring your 2. I mean, there's times we have like 12 recorders out. It gets a little funny when Shane and I are trying to remember where all these recorders are, especially when we bury them or hide them underneath,
well,
you know, moss or everything.
We
else.
Rarely GPS them. We rarely GPS them. We try to go off.
No, we
memory.
Don't.
We should GPS them.
Yeah, we go off them. We've never done that. We've somehow never lost a recorder, although we've had a couple hour searches. It's over here.
Yeah.
So hey, folks, let's see. If you guys got your pen and paper, I'll tell you how to set your recorders up. The format should be an MP3, and at 320 kilohertz. The sample rate should be at 44.1 kilohertz. All the recorders are stereo, so we won't go into that. The size or the duration of your file should be 64 megabytes or 27 minutes. Most recorders have this ability to do most of this stuff. So if you wrote that down, try to set up your recorders accordingly, or re-listen to the show and try to set it up. I think that would be a great help for everybody. And what that does is allows you to email files back and forth to other folks, or to myself, or David, or any other person that's good with bioacoustics. They'd be able to analyze these files, as they won't be too terribly big. They'll be detailed with the best quality that you could possibly have, given the technology that we have right now.
It makes it easier to go back and listen, because when I first got involved with audio recording, I was using Sony's and Tascams, and I really didn't have my settings correct. And all the settings you just mentioned were something I learned later on. But I would listen straight through, 12 hours of recording, even if something of interest that I heard in person happened, I have to fast forward and try and find it. Whereas, these increments of recording make it much simpler to listen to and dial down as to, the time frame of when something transpired, when something happened. And that's very important. And it also, like you were mentioning, Larry, it makes it, these files make it easier to send to people, whether it's someone in the Bigfoot world or a naturalist or somebody that's involved with audio to send them to them in these increments. It makes life so much easier. It's something that I learned over time, over many years, and something that David Ellis and such yourself, Larry, have taught me with audio. And, man, it's really made my experience that much easier, and it makes for better listening.
Absolutely, it does. You listen, I look and listen. But the whole thing is, with this size of a file, it's easier, especially with what I do with the bioacoustics, of looking at the bioacoustic signatures using through spectral analysis. I'm able to go through a file and take a look for the anomalous things that are. I'm so used to looking at files, folks, is that I could take a look at a file and I could tell you from just a signature without even having my headphones on, that's a barred owl, that's a coyote. Those are crickets. This big buzzing thing, that thing there that runs across the screen is a insect that hasn't shut up. And we've had those nights.
Oh, yeah.
It just ruins audio. But the whole point of the matter is I'm looking at this stuff, and I'm looking down in the lower registry for some more anomalous signatures that fit what we call the sweet spot. Granted, there are some high-pitched calls, like the Ohio call is going to be a little bit higher. Some of the recordings I've had are a little bit higher, but most of the stuff is down lower in the lower registry. That's more of a sweet spot that I look for. Also, there's a difference with, for instance, human voices kind of look like a little comma. Suspected Sasquatch sounds, they kind of got a comma, but it's more thicker, a little bit lower than our registry, where it lays in the sweet spot, and there's kind of a thicker, curly Q type of a look to it. I show it along the top, like you're skidding on the highway. It's like, oh, there it is right there. And then we listen and go,
right.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Right, Shane?
Yeah. No, absolutely. But Larry, what when you're listening to audio, since we're on the subject, I want to talk a little bit more about placement of audio and actually placement of anything. We talk about a lot about trail cameras and how we don't get anything out of them. But when you're looking at audio, what are you specifically, as Larry Turner, looking for? You mentioned a little bit about the differences in sounds and recognizing those. But what are you specifically looking for that you find suspect when you're listening to a recording, whether you've heard in person or just recorded it? What are you looking for?
Well, like I said, everything out there, whether it's a barred owl, a coyote, or bobcat, fox, bear, They all have their signature sweet spots. We're going to call it that for just this, for the sake of trying to speed this up. They all have their signature sweet spots, and it ranges in a specific frequency range. Like, for instance, coyotes kind of hover around the 20 kilohertz range. They can go up and down in there a little bit. Foxes are just a little bit above or below. They're very boisterous. They got many different calls that could really confuse a person if you're not used to hearing fox calls. They got quite a repertoire. Coyotes, they have different calls too, so you got to be understand what you're listening to, but they all have this little sweet spot. Just draw yourself a box and put like five lines on it. Well, the top line would be the birds and insects, and then as you move down towards the center, or say the third line, that would be somewhere the coyote range, the fox range, if you would. Then the fourth line would be sort of like the human range talking. And then there's a fifth line from the floor. And then to the fifth line, or the fifth line as you're coming down from the top. That's kind of the area that I look for, that I look in to see something that's anomalous. And what I mean by that is you have ground, for lack of a better term, you'll have some wind that. But the real strong signals, if you would show up in that lower registry area. Again, that's not to say that suspected Bigfoot or Sasquatch calls can't go into the upper registry. They do. They're kind of in between and above sometimes in the coyote range as well. So it's kind of a hard thing to describe, but you get used to seeing this stuff so much that you can see the difference between a coyote and a suspected Bigfoot call, definitely barred owls. You know, they're just a signature of all their own, kind of like a hook type of a comma type look.
Right.
And so, you know, you just know, and you just kind of look, and you see me go through a 28 minute file in 5 minutes. And if I see something, I'm dead on it, you know, and you go, how did you do that? Well, that's kind of what I do on my sleep, you know, that type of thing. Does that kind of explain it?
No, it does perfectly, Larry. And what it showcases here is the amount of time it takes to really get to know software, and not just software, but also what you're listening to. It takes countless hours, as I know I have spent and you have spent, and people like David Ellis of the Olympic Project and others. There's many others out there that have done the same, other research groups and individuals. I mean, if you look at naturalists and those that record sounds from nature, whether it's a bird guy or a bear guy, it's something that takes a lot of experience and a lot of time-tested time in the field and listening to recordings, and then perfecting your recording devices and placing those in the optimum, spots. Something that requires skill, because it's something that's developed over time. Something that I can appreciate having done it.
One thing we should probably talk about, some folks out here have got their own research areas. I don't know if they've ever heard of audio triangulation. Now, this is something that we've done in our area. Most of our sounds, like a lot of times, were coming from the east, and we decided to do audio or bioacoustic triangulation. And what that is you set, say, one recorder facing east, say, to the right of your area, maybe 300 yards. And then you go another 300 yards from that point from center over, so they're about 600 yards apart and facing that east, and then you bring a third one up another 600 yards and facing that east. That's the audio or bioacoustic triangulation, and what that does is help you determine where exactly the sound or the subject is calling from. All three recorders will pick up the sound, but which one's going to have the strongest sound? That's where you key in. That's triangulation.
No, Absolutely fantastic, Larry. I mean, this is great stuff. You know, we are speaking a little bit about to those that actually are out researching, but also to those inquisitive on the subject about how people go out recording stuff, as I perceive it to be the right way. And it's another show topic down the road, for sure. But, Larry, we're closing on the end of the show. I do appreciate you and your insight and your thoughts. It's been a fascinating show. It's something I love to discuss. I can't discuss this subject enough, the Sasquatch phenomenon and then the science behind it and what we're doing to further the research and better ourselves in understanding what's going on in our natural environment. I mean, it's been a fascinating discussion tonight, and I appreciate you joining me, Larry.
Yeah, I had a blast. Anytime, anywhere, buddy. I'm here.
Absolutely, Larry. No, hey, you're always a fascinating guy to talk to, and I know you have a ton of experience in the woods, and you're one of the guys that I go to, one of my favorite people to research in the field with because of your thought process and your demeanor. You don't easily scare, and you don't easily scare anything else around you. So I appreciate that, Larry, and thanks for joining.
Yeah, my pleasure, always.
All right, Larry, well, have a great evening. Thank you.
Hey, no problem. Catch you later, man.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Monstrux Radio. It's a fascinating discussion, you know, when it comes to audio and being in the field. I think there's a lot to be said about your demeanor and how you approach the Sasquatch phenomena. There's a lot to be said about that. And I think that there's just a lot to be done and furthered in this sort of aspect, this sort of research, this sort of thought process when it comes to the research. It's not really talked about a whole lot. You get people out there researching, and it's all gung-ho and this and that, but they don't really stop to see the forest of the trees or really take in their environment or spend a lot of time in their environment. And Larry and I were discussing tonight, you know, there's a lot to it. It's not just placing audio. It's not just listening to what capability you think you're able to listen to. But if nothing else, after all is said and done, whether you're a Sasquatch researcher or one that enjoys the woods, get out and enjoy your natural environment. Get out and enjoy that, because it'll do you good, it'll do your family good, it'll do your kids good, it'll do your friends good. Get out and enjoy and listen, and really soak in what's right there, right beyond your window, right beyond which maybe sometimes you're comfortable with. But get out there and enjoy it. And the sky's the limit. Who knows what could happen? Who knows what you could hear or see? And really take that in. But I do appreciate all you guys listening to Monstrux Radio. I'm Shane Corson, and we'll catch you again next week for another episode of Monstrux Radio. Thank you.
Thank you for joining Monstrux Radio.